All the way.
From California. All the way from Northridge. Oh, hi, everybody. My name's Corinne Elrod, and I am an Al-Anon. And I am so grateful to be here. I came into this magnificent program October the 30th, 1980. And for that, I will be forever, forever grateful. I want to thank John and the committee for asking me to come and share. You know, when you go away to Montana or Texas or some other state, and you talk, nobody knows you. I mean, very few people know who you are. Very few people have watched you grow up. And in this room, that's not the truth. In this room is full of people who have watched me grow up and who I've grown up with. My contemporaries, the people who were in the enthusiastic part of Al-Anon when I first came into the rooms. The people who changed my life forever and ever, who taught me a way to live that's beyond my wildest dreams. And the last 2 years have been really hard for me. I am someone who likes to be in the rooms. I like to watch people walk into the room because I'm very visual. I like to watch them walk in, see how they're dressed. No, not because of what they're wearing, but how they're dressed, how they're carrying themselves, what their eyes look like, what their expression's like. When you're in a room and you're in a room with people who are there for their meetings, we come to our meetings so we can get recovery. And when you watch them walk in, you can tell whether they're in a good place or whether they're not in a good place. And it doesn't register the same over Zoom for me. And I miss seeing people. And I think all of us are a little in shock. I know I'm still in a little bit of shock about seeing people and being around people and trying to readjust to what that looks like and how that is. We were at San Fernando together. We had a wonderful time at San Fernando. And that was like home, because San Fernando Convention's home to me. I remember the first time Betty Ann made me go, and Sally, and what we did, and how we played, and how new it was, and the escalator going down to the main floor, and they put me, I mean, it was unbelievable, watching people together, all together, in alcoholism and in Al-Anon, what I didn't even know what it was. So I'm going to share with you a little bit about what it was like and what happened and what it's like today. But I want you to know that because you guys are in the room and you know me, it's really throwing me off my game. So I'm going to, I noticed a lot of people read things up here. So I just want to read something that I wrote this morning. I brought my journal. I have to make sure no one gets it because it has really private things in it back there. But I always write a letter to God in the morning. And this morning, this is what I wrote. March the 27th. Good morning, Father. Thank you for this day, this beautiful Sunday. This morning, Father, I need your help. I've been asked to speak and share my experience in Al-Anon at AFG convention. I'm a bit anxious this morning and unsettled. Please come and help me to be of love and service to my fellows this morning, to share my experience, strength, and hope with all that are here, and to help open up myself to be used by you in this talk to open the eye and the hearts that you would have me do. Bless this and all the wonderful Al-Anon and AA that I have received as a gift. So, that being said, I'm just gonna start and tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I was born. But I'm really grateful I was born. And I was born and I was adopted into a family 3 days later. So I have a very special place in my heart for my birth mother, who made a decision to help to have me and to bring me into this world. And the doctor called my parents that were to become my parents and asked them if they wanted a little baby girl, because my mother had had a hard time conceiving and holding on to baby, holding on to her pregnancies. And they said, of course. And I walked into the most magical family in the whole wide world. My parents, like Michael, my husband Michael, calls him Mr. and Mrs. Can you hear me? Hi, my name's Corinne. And I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. And I want to thank all of you for being here. So I was born, and like I said, I was born. And actually, my birthday's tomorrow, so that's... My birthday is tomorrow. I'm getting my other cataract removed. That's what happens when you get old. You have cataract. I'm getting that removed, and I'm really happy. But my mother and father were magical. And they were like Mr. and Mrs. Claus. There was love in our family. We did things together. We ate together. We read together. We played together. They took us on vacations. My father was the kind of guy, I remember one time I probably was about 5 or 6, and we had gone out to dinner at an Italian restaurant. And my mother said, oh, I miss my sister who lived in Louisiana. Oh, I miss my sister. And he says, you do? She said, yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen her. And my dad said, well, you want to go visit her? And she said, yeah, when? He goes, tonight? So we went home and packed, and my dad took the money back to his partner from the house and gave it to him. And we went on a vacation, and we went for a drive. And we drove across country, and we went to visit her sister. And my parents had me in the back of the car, and we'd ride. And this is how my mother handled a young 5-year-old in the back of a car. The car was old car, because it was a long time ago, and it didn't have air conditioning. It didn't have air conditioning. I hate this mic. What's that one?
That's recording.
Oh, good. It's like a snake. It's like a snake. Hi. So the car had no air conditioning, so my father loved gadgets, so he put this thing in the window that you put water in it. See, you know what I'm talking about. You put water in it, and then when you drive, the faster you drive, the more the thing goes around, and it spits water at you. And it cools you off. And that was our air conditioner. And we drove across country with that, and I was bored, and I had a seat in the back that was made out like a bed, and I'd want to get, you know, where are we going, where are we going, where are we going? And they'd stop, and my mother would give me a pill. And then she'd give me ice cubes, and the ice cubes all had circles. They were like rings, and I'd suck on my fingers, and I'd pass out. And they drugged me all the way across all the way across the country. Every time I woke up, and we weren't going someplace to get out, they'd give me some more ice cubes on my fingers and give me a pill. And my parents drank a lot. Everyone in my family drank. It's just what they all did. And it never seemed to be a problem. It never really was a problem. My dad wasn't somebody that got mad. When my father got angry and he got mad, he slammed doors and went for walks. He did have a punching bag in the garage, but that's when he was really angry. And so I had this grandfather who... I've learned so many different things about myself. My grandfather was magic to me. He lived in Inglewood, and actually, I was born in Inglewood. He lived in Hawthorne, and he had a pigeon ranch. My grandfather had graduated from Cornell University. He had started trade routes at the turn of the century in Japan. He was an elitist. He had tons of money, and his friend and him made different kinds of investments, and he lost all his money in the crash. And his daughters had housekeepers and butlers and drivers and all sorts of things, and he lost all the money, and he decided that he needed to move, and he took his family to California. And he went to Agoura. You know where the Indian, any of you know that know where the Indian is in Agoura? My grandmother was one of the first people to paint that Indian. And my mother rode her horse around. They had a house across the street from it. And he ended up, because he was an elitist in those days, he decided, and he'd gone to Cornell, he understood a lot of things, he went to Hawthorne to open a pigeon ranch. Because in those days, squab was the thing to eat. And my mother would pluck the squabs. I can remember sitting in the grain bin, and my aunt and my grandfather and my mother butchering the pigeons and sticking them in the cans, and my grandfather throwing them to my mother, and she'd pluck them, and my cousin and I would play in the grain bins. But this man wasn't raised that way. He was raised with manners and kindness and a different kind of thing, and he made magic. He told stories, and he played with me, and he made everything magical. And I will forever be grateful to him for what it was. My grandmother, I remember her just a little bit. But my mother grew up in that kind of a family. And in that family, at one point, Tennessee Williams came to live with them. Tennessee Williams did not live on a chicken ranch. He lived on a squab ranch. And and he came there with my grandfather's nephew. And the book, The Captain's Table, is kind of after what our families was like. Everybody drank, and it was crazy. And it was full of different things that happened. My grandmother was an artist, and she would just go in the back and paint. She'd go into her studio, and she'd paint, and the wildness and the craziness would happen. But I didn't see any of that, because those days had passed, and now I'm a little girl, and I'm over there, and he's making magic. I remember one day, I was already in program. You cannot hear? Okay. I hate these things. I'm having a hard time with this. I'm sorry, guys. I remember, I have a very soft voice. I'm terrible that way. So my life unfolds, and I grow up, and everybody drinks. My father was very happy when Tupperware came out with those tall glasses with the lid on them, because he didn't have to put the glass in between his legs and it didn't spill on him when he drove home from work. He owned a lumber yard, and we grew up just happy with the neighborhood, and everybody drank, and everybody did what they did. So when I was in school, I was a swimmer, and I was practicing to go to the Olympics in Mexico. And my father's friend came over, and they were drinking, of course, and he had a surfboard. And I loved the water, and so I went to go surfing. I wanted to go surfing, and he said, well, I'll bring you a board. So he brought me a board. So as soon as I got a board, I figured, I'll just start surfing. And the hell with swimming. So I never, stuck on anything. But my parents weren't people that made me stick on something. They were like, if you want to do it, do it. If you don't want to do it, don't do it. I was a good girl, and so I started surfing. And then I met Bob, the surfer. And Bob and I had surfing adventures together, and we went together for a really long time. And then it came time for me to graduate from high school and go to college, and I knew I was going to go to college, but I didn't really want to go to college, and I wanted to surf. And I found this college. Now, I always made my own clothes. And I always you know, I made my own clothes and I did whatever. And so I thought, wait a second, maybe I found this school for fashion design. So if I go to this school, I checked the schedule out. It had great schedule for me to still be able to surf. So I told my parents I wanted to become a fashion designer. So I went to this school, and then I went to college to become a fashion designer. And then Bob and I broke up, and I didn't surf as much anymore. But I met this other guy who was taking me to places that my mother had never raised me to go. And and he was the man that I was to learn that you cannot make somebody love you if they don't love you. But I want to have him love me. And my thing is if I just do this or if I just do that, he's going to love me. And I was wrong. And it broke my heart. Now, by this time, I'm working. I've graduated from college. I'm working at a profession. I'm starting to travel all over the world. And and I have this girlfriend, Rhonda, that I went to school with. And Rhonda and I, this one night, decided she wanted me to drive. She was going to spend the night. So she decided that she wanted me to go with her because she was like breaking up with her boyfriend. I had to go to Hollywood with her. He lived on Cherokee and Hollywood Boulevard. And he lived in this little, very untasteful one-room apartment with a little refrigerator. And I drank hot vodka while the two of them argued and broke up because he had told her that he was planning on becoming president of the United States and that she was not first lady quality. We had also started doing some drugs at this point. Just to let you know, there was a little drug going on. So there we are, and I'm thinking, oh my God, now I have a new car. I have a new Oldsmobile Cutlass, brown. And I decide that I'm going to drive home. I live in Van Nuys at the time. I'm going to drive home over the canyon and have something pretty because this has been a real pain in the ass kind of night with her. So we're driving down Hollywood Boulevard. And we go in front of Grauman's Chinese, and the light turns red, and we're stopped at the corner of Hollywood and La Brea. So I had really long blonde hair. I remember what I had on, and I look over, and there's this VW van, and there's this guy with these long mutton chops and this great big walrus mustache sitting in the van, and he's toking on a joint. And he looks over at me, and he passes the joint out the window. And I take the joint, put it in my mouth, roll my window up, the light changes, and I drive off. He starts chasing us. I pull over and Rhonda is screaming, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" I'm like, "Shut up, Rhonda. Take a toke." We go for a little ride. I give him my phone number. He was a cute kid because by this time my heart had been broken and I was starting to go out with only people that could take me to really nice places. I could call it slut puppy hoeing, but Betty Ann's not here. So I go home and I'm loaded. And so I decide I'm gonna fix, it's like midnight, and I'm gonna redo picture frames for my office. And I burn perfect circles in my eyes because I have hard contact lenses. And I went blind because of the heart, I cut my eyes. So I was blind, 21, blind, crazy, and this kid keeps calling, and my sister keeps answering the phone. And I'm not talking to him on Monday. I'm not talking to him on Tuesday. I'm not talking to him on Wednesday, but I am starting to feel better. By Thursday, my sister and him have a relationship. she's found out that she likes him. And so by Thursday, she says, you need to talk to him. So I talked to him. He asked me to go out. I say, what could hurt? So I'm bored. So this guy with the mutton chop and the comes over, and he takes me to the Pier 7. Girls 18 or older to get in, boys 21. Sawdust on the floor, wine bottles that they refill at the bar. I've been going to the best places in Beverly Hills, but now I'm in this, what used to be a lube, an oil joint, I think, with this guy with these mutton chops and all of this. And then, of course, we went back to his apartment after that, and at one point the police came. There were lights on the screen between the bedroom and the living room, if you get my drift. And and the police were there, and we almost got busted. Well, about a week later, we were in a similar position, and and he asked me to marry him. I never said yes. I just started planning the wedding, because because the way things were going, I was not proud of who I was and what I was doing. I wasn't acting like I was raised to be act like, but that's what I was doing. And my father seemed to really like him, and because he's a really likable guy. And we will be married 51 years this year. So my sweetheart is Michael, and we've been married forever, and we've gone through all sorts of different changes and all sorts of different things. Like I said, everyone in my family drank, and using drugs was part of my generation, and that's what we did. So that's what we did. And so, you know, Michael worked. I still worked as a fashion designer, and I still traveled a lot. And we were having trouble getting pregnant. And Michael had surgery to be able, that was one of his first surgeries that he had. And we got, Mikey came along to us. And I think that was the longest time I had ever seen my husband sober was during my delivery, my labor. I remember one time when there was downhill skiing, we were watching while I was in labor with Mikey, and the thing went off, and Michael was looking at it, and I folded him over my arm. You know, I just hit him, and he folded over the arm, and then I had the baby, and my parents came, took my husband out to drink, and you know, there we were, and I had this little baby. I had been working for a company that, while I was pregnant, because of the company and the contract that I had, they gave me 7.5 months off because of the fact I was under contract, and they didn't want to have me do this particular line. It was too expensive, so I was off my whole pregnancy, and we redid our house while I was off. And I remember that, and I remember that what happened was I'm in the hospital, and I get a call from the secretary of the president. She says, your plane tickets are arriving at your house tomorrow. Next Tuesday, you'll go to San Francisco for a conference, and then you're off to the Orient for 6 weeks. And we had to hire a housekeeper and somebody to watch the kids. I think about that today, and I think, man, was I crazy. Because all I cared about was what that housekeeper was going to look like. Because I had a man at home and a baby. My parents didn't live too far away. But this woman needed to look like a gold tooth here, you know, striped socks, you know, short, you know, older, whatever. And I got a reference from a girlfriend of mine, and I opened the door for the interview, and there she stood. And I didn't ask her a lot of questions. She fit the bill. And that's what I did. And I got on an airplane. Luckily, my parents lived really close, and they watched after everything that was happening. But I look back on it, and I think, what the hell kind of mom are you? You know, mothers today, check out the this, check out the that. What are you doing? What are you not doing? How are you doing it? Who is she? What are her credentials? What's your background? No. Tooth, fat, funky, I'm fine. Michael was uncomfortable with the housekeeper because he didn't know how to have a housekeeper, and so he wanted her to eat dinner with us. I'm like, are you crazy? But that's what we did. And I remember one time she got really drunk and I had to clean up her puke. They aren't exactly the period of things you really want to talk about till you look good, but that's how my life was, and that's what we did. We drank a lot, and we had a lot of parties. We had great parties, Halloween parties with 150 people going through things. I mean, we had great parties. The last party that we had, Michael went to the hospital. Somebody nailed him in the face, and he cracked his face open, but we had great parties. We had a bowl of punch, and I was so crazy that I'd go around, and everybody was everywhere, and I'd take the glasses that were still full, that didn't have cigarette butts in them, and I'd pour them back in the punch. So it was like, it seemed to work, and everyone had a lovely time. So our little kid is growing up in this. Mikey's growing up in this wildness, this craziness that's going on. Bingo, Yahtzee, cocaine time. And, and I remember when I first found that in the house, and I was so angry. I was so mad. How dare you bring this into the house? How dare you do this? And pretty soon, not too long later, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning. We're playing darts at my friend's house, at our friend's house, and our baby's sleeping under the coffee table. And the sun's going to come up, and I got to go to work. And we go home, and Michael goes to bed, and I go in to get dressed. And I hear him say from outside, why don't you do a couple of lines? You'll feel better. And my thought was, the reason I don't feel good is because I've done a couple of lines. I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to get up and I'm going to go. So what's starting to happen is I'm starting to pull away. I'm starting to see the tragedy of what our life looks like. We're getting in fights. Michael's behavior is becoming more and more difficult. I lay in bed in the morning and I hear the pumper. We had gotten my father a great big pumper that if you squirt the top, it gives you a full jigger. I would lay in bed and I would hear the pumper first thing in the morning with Michael. First I'd hear the chopping, and then I'd hear the, pumper. And it was a one pumper, two pumper, three pumper morning for him to get going to go to work at my father's lumberyard. He had employment security. And that's what we did for a long time. During this period of time, I would fall into rages with my kid because it was too much. When he would get upset, and he was starting to, and I sent him to like the perfect school. He had to go to a Waldorf school. Yes, if you know Waldorf, yes, because it's very good for them. So because they'll, fairies, and it's lovely. And it didn't look like what our house looked like. So one day I'm having a little discussion with our son, Michael, and he won't go to bed. And he won't go to bed. And I start screaming at him. And he has this Dino dog. And I need to tell you that I didn't remember this. We were at a conference, and our son Michael was speaking at the conference in Monterey or some Morro Bay. He was speaking at the conference, and my sponsor, Vinoy, was sitting next to me. And as he started to tell this story, my body must have changed, because she said, "You had forgotten this, hadn't you?" And I said, "Yes," but when he started telling the story, I remembered every second of it. What had happened is I had flown into a rage, and he would not get in bed. And we went back and forth on it, and pretty soon I took his Dino doll, and I told him to get in bed, and I wasn't kind about it, and I went to the kitchen, and I took the Dino, his favorite stuffed animal, and I opened the trash compactor, and I pulled out the up the trash, and I threw the thing into it, and I pushed the button, and the reason I know what time of year it was is we're not in program yet, because I could hear the gallon. I don't know about you guys, but when you drink a lot of wine and you do a lot of drugs, you have to buy gallons. You can't buy just bottles because there's too many of them. So I could hear those big gallon glass bottles pop as I pushed the button. And I got back and to see if he was in bed, and he was out again, and I spanked him and put him back in bed. And I went and took the trash out, and I threw it in the trash. And then I had a moment of clarity. What in the hell are you doing, Corinne? You just smashed your son's favorite flippin' toy. You know, what in the world? So I got Dino out, and I looked at him, and he was filthy, so I put him in the washing machine, and I washed him, and I blow-dried him, and I pulled him out so I can give him back and be a good mom and give him back his toy. And little Dino, you know, they had these little heads, and Dino's head was, and his neck was broken, and I couldn't make him stand up, and I gave it back to my kid, and he told that story from the podium. And when he told that story, I had totally blocked that out of my mind. I did not remember it at all. So if I'm doing that with my kid, what am I doing with myself? We have 3 Afghan hounds at this time. 3 Afghan hounds. Most of the time they look like molding reindeer, because I had to shave them, because you couldn't, you know, grooming one's bad enough, but 3 is like way too much. And then, you know, I mean, I'm just doing the best I can, and I'm going to the Orient, and I'm going here, and I'm going there, and I'm going to New York, and every time I go, Michael drives me, and all the way to there we fight about it, because I'm writing out bills and paying bills while we're doing it, because that's how I took over everything. So one morning I get up to go to work, and I walk in and open the garage door to say hi to the animals. And 2 of them, because we had to have them stop sleeping with us, they were pushing us out of bed. So I go in, and my oldest dog, my mama kiss, is dead, and she's on the ground. And I usually take care of everything. I don't know if you're the Al-Anon of that variety, but I usually take care of everything. I didn't take care of everything. I called Michael. I said, you need to come home. And he came home, and I went to get in the car. And he said, you can't. I said, I'm leaving. You got to take care of this. And that was the morning that Michael had his moment of clarity, and he decided to check himself into the hospital, and he went to the hospital. He went to Pathways, and it was a Friday night, and it was his first time in. And the reason Michael went to an alcoholic ward is because our doctor had met Michael several times. We had called him on different occasions when my girlfriend and I were figuring that Michael needed help. And smoking dope, doing lines, drinking wine, and lighting our fingernails on fire, because you have to be careful with those lighters when you're smoking. So Michael... The beds were, he was going to put him in the psychiatric ward because they didn't know that much about alcoholism, and the doctor was going to put him in the psychiatric ward, and the ward was full. And he thought, wait a second, Mike drinks, and there's a hospital across the street, and if I put Mike in that hospital, I can get into that hospital. I can get my name on that hospital, and that's what I can do. So Michael got into recovery and into this particular hospital for the recovery because the beds were full in the psych ward. it wasn't like anybody recognized it, and he was so loaded, he just, that's where he went. And it was the first night of, what was that movie? Miami Vice. It was the first night of Miami Vice. It was a Friday night, and Michael went to the hospital. The next week, I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. They had an Al-Anon meeting on Wednesday nights and on Friday nights at the unit. And at that Al-Anon meeting, my sister made me go. And I was trying to figure out how not to do it, but my sister made me go. So that night, there was an old-timer there. And the old-timer who was there, her name was Lenny. And she'd been in Al-Anon before there was Al-Anon, when AA's took her and taught her the program by the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Lenny knew I was new because she was on the unit and she always was a part of the unit. So she asked me to read Understanding Ourselves. I was brand new. She didn't ask who wants to read. She didn't, can I see the hands of people who would like to read? She didn't do that. She said, read this. And I'm like, okay. So I read it, and I couldn't figure out how you got me on the page. I couldn't figure out how I got on the page of that. What? How does that happen? You know, this program that you guys, you're talking about, you know, the miracle in motion. My miracle in motion is that Michael and I stayed alive long enough to be able to find y'all. That's a miracle. Our son Mikey stayed alive long enough to find y'all. You know, that's our first giant miracle. We never killed each other in all the times that we were drunk and cuckoo. So that Saturday, I went to my first AA meeting. There was an AA meeting, they were rebuilding it, and it was in a trailer. And I went with Michael. I could go, I could have been sure, of course, but I just sat there and I watched AA and I watched the AA meeting happen, and I watched my husband raise his hand as an alcoholic for the first time. And something hit me. He's in the hospital. I just read this thing that tells me who I am. What? How is this possible? And I watch him raise his hand. And as I walk out of the trailer and go down the steps, I say my first prayer. God, please help him and let him get sober and help him to live and help us both to live. It's my first prayer that I ever said in Al-Anon and really meant and was really sincere about it. So that's when we started getting into action. I mean, I went to 2 Al-Anon meetings. You have to look out for new sobriety, because what happens with new sobriety is you can get pregnant. But, and I did. Now, one of the things I have remembered along the way here, and it also went out of my memory, is that my oldest son, Michael, right after Michael was in the hospital and out maybe a few months, maybe 6 months, 8 months, we had friends. He had a guy that was in the unit with him that they both were in the service at the same time. They both got sober at the same time. They both had all the same problems. And they had a family the same as our family. Everything was like similar. And our son Mikey was like 5. And he ended up in the hospital with really bad asthma or something. He never has had asthma since. But he had really bad asthma, and he was in a tent, a breathing tent, for 5 days. Those are the things that you kind of block out. You don't want to remember them. But somehow God showed me, you know, this is what we do. This is who we are. So I'm going to meetings. I start going to this meeting called Have Al-Anon Will Grow. And it's a Monday night meeting. It's in Encino. They have it at this church. Then they move that church to another church. And I'm going to that meeting. So I'm going to these meetings. I'm going to that meeting. And one night, as I'm at that meeting, this woman walks in the room. And she's crying. Now, I don't think I ever saw her before this, but she's crying. And she goes to people in the room, and they're talking to her. And then the meeting starts, and she shares. And then after the meeting, she's laughing. That was such an attraction to me. It sounds like split personality, but it was such an attraction because I was not capable of talking to people. I didn't want to open up to somebody, and I see her, and she's doing this, and then she does that. And I had already tried to have a sponsor, and I had to have somebody that knew me, so they knew who I was. I had to leave her as a sponsor because I told her I could never get a hold of her. And she said, well, if you call me before 8 o'clock in the morning, I'm always there. And I thought, oh, before 8 in the morning, she's so cute. I wasn't willing to go to any length. So this woman, I go over to her, and I decide I'm going to ask her to sponsor me. I bet you can't guess who that woman was. It was Betty Ann. And Betty Ann taught me how to get in the damn car. Get in the car. And get in the car. We're going to go here. We're going to go here. You know, one day she says, get in the car. I said, what are we doing? She goes, shut up. And we go off someplace, and she's got groceries, and she says, get out of the car, run to the front porch, put the groceries on the front porch, push the button, and get back in the car. I'm like, what? She says, just follow directions. Okay. So I started following directions and following her around and doing the things that she did. I have the privilege of being at the first four-step getaway. Before it really was a four-step getaway, it was the first four-step getaway. It was in Cambria. And there was a group of us, and a bunch of us went up together. And then there were some other people in Cambria that went. It was at this lodge. I was in a room with 8 other people, and or a million, it felt like. And let's remember, I only stayed in the best hotels. And I'm in this thing. And she did something that night. She told her story. But she not only told her story, she told her story in a way that was intimate, honest, real, no holds bar, no secrets. And that honesty was really something. Now, when I first went to go to that meeting, Michael had a VW. And I drove the VW because they took my cars away after I became unemployable. My car went away. So I'm driving Michael's VW to Betty Ann's house in Thousand Oaks. And I almost turn around 2 or 3 times because I don't know how to go and do something for myself. I only know how to go and do something for business. And it was the first time I ever did anything for myself that was just for me. And I was scared to death. So while everybody else was playing and doing all sorts of things, she had explained the four-step thing, and Saturday came and she explained it and all of this. And I knew if I didn't get it written out, I was never going to get it done. I needed to do it then, right then, that day. So where everybody else went to play or went to dinner or whatever, I just wrote. And I wrote all night long. And I happened to drive with her, which she had a little fastback sports car. I don't know how she drives today, but how she drives then is amazing. She's still driving. And I sat and read my fourth step to her on the way home. And then Kay Dornbush, we stopped for lunch, and Kay Dornbush got in the back seat of this little sports car and listened to my sex inventory along with me. So, you know, Kay and I, now I sponsor her, so that's okay. But I entered into what was to be a fellowship that blossomed in front of me. And the blossoming in front of me that happened was recovery. When you start working the steps and you look at the things that you find in the steps and you turn to what those are, and it's magnificent. I looked at the Blueprint for Progress. I'm so grateful I didn't do that. Yes, no, maybe, sometimes, maybe. Whatever. That, you know, the out of the big book, it really shows us how to do it, how to really look at ourselves and really take a look at who we are. You can't lie about it. You can't. You have to do the work. And you look at the columns, and the columns lead you to the next thing that leads you to the next thing that leads you to the next thing. It's so magnificent. I came to a place in my program where it was time for Betty Ann and I became extremely close. We did everything together. We were like sidekicks. We did everything together. And at one point in time, I found it necessary for me to not have her as a sponsor, because I realized that our relationship was so close, and I couldn't do it anymore. And there was a woman that Betty Ann had brought into my life, whose name is Vinoy Shah. And I started calling Vinoy because I think she was sponsoring Betty Ann at the time. And when Betty Ann was out of time, I'd call Vinoy. And Vinoy would give me very short, plain program answers of action. Simple, direct, that was it. Betty Ann saved my life. She'd say things like, when I was first sponsored by her, "Stop sitting on that corner of the sofa." And I'd think, "What? How does she know where I'm sitting?" And I was sitting on that sofa. And this was when, you know, you had the phones and they were attached to the thing, and I had to move. The reason I was sitting on the sofa, I had a 20-foot cord, and I would pull the cord over to the sofa because the phone hung right next to the refrigerator and I was gaining weight. So I had to pull the cord over to do it. And it was really something to have to let go of that friendship and let go of that relationship. It didn't go well in the beginning. Because she didn't understand that I loved her so much, but I couldn't do it anymore. And I started another journey with Vinoy. A lot of things have happened in our lives, Michael, in my life. And I know a lot of things have happened in your lives, but there's earmarks of what it is. So Toscan comes along, and Betty Ann told me, well, she still sponsored me, absolutely. She said, "You and Michael are sick. And because you're sick, your kids need to go to Alateen." I said, "Well, he doesn't want to go to Alateen." And she says things back like, "I didn't ask you if he wanted to go to Alateen. I said he's going to go to Alateen because you guys are sick and he has to go to Alateen." So that's what we had to do. He had to go to Alateen. And I remember taking this little pudgy guy to Alateen and dropping him off. And he came out and he told me that he hated it. And when he was doing that talk and he talked about his Dino dog, he said, "I loved it from the very moment I walked in. But I couldn't have you guys be right. You couldn't be right, but I loved it from the very moment that I came in." Now we have Toscan and we have Mikey, and they're both going to Alateen, and they're active members of Alateen. And Michael's being chairman of a convention, and our kids are getting busted by the cops in the parking lot. And you know, and I've learned to do things like, now the kids and they, all the Alateens, and I say, you got to go home. You know, my mom's picking you up. He's like, "What do you mean? I'm at the convention." I said, "Oh, I don't care. You broke the law. You're out of here. Your father's head of security. Guess what? You're out of here." So I learned how to start talking to them and behaving like a mother, and it was really a joy. It was a joy to be a mom. So I have this best friend, Jennifer, that I told you about with the fingernail that went on fire, and she and I had been best friends since junior high. She had purple fingernails in junior high. I couldn't figure out where she got purple fingernails. She was magnificent. And she drank a lot and did a lot of drugs, just like I did. And one night we come back from San Fernando because we're not staying at the hotel, and we come back and the phone rings and it's midnight, and I say, I answer the phone and it's Jennifer, and she says, I can't keep drinking like this. I said, you're talking to the wrong person. And I pass the phone to Michael. And Michael doesn't like being interrupted from his sleep in the middle of the night. And he says to her, if you're serious, meet me at the house at 7 o'clock. I'm going to an AA meeting. Be here. And it hung the phone up. So 6:30 in the morning, I'm in the kitchen. I'm making coffee, getting ready to go to the conference. And I look up, and here comes Jennifer. But Jennifer doesn't look like Jennifer. I haven't seen her in a long time. Her face is bloated out to here. She just looks terrible. Jennifer went to San Fernando and she took the book at the countdown. And she stayed sober, but she got terminal cancer. And she had this sweet little girl. And Jennifer and I were really good friends, but because of her alcoholism and us being in program, we didn't see each other that often because now we're in different worlds again. And now she's in AA, and her little girl's like 14. Now her little girl's 16. And Jennifer comes down with terminal cancer. And she calls me up and she says, I'm dying of terminal cancer. And I start going to see her. Now I'm working a program. I have a God in my life. I'm in good stead. I sponsor a lot of people. I'm very active. And Jennifer is starting to go to AA meetings, and she's loving it. And then the cancer gets worse, and it gets worse. And she says to me, you know this God thing that they have in the program? I said, yeah. I said, she goes, do you really believe in that? I said, yeah, I do. She said, how did you learn how to believe in it? I said, because I had really good priests and I have really good friends and we talk about it. And I said, would you like to talk to somebody about it? And I'm active in my church, and so I talked to the priest, and he had a guy that came out, a priest that came out and talked to her 2 times a week. And he shared with her. And she decided she wanted to be baptized, and she decided that she wanted to be confirmed. I belong to a portion of the church that they still wear their robes, and they still have bells and whistles and smoke and all kinds of stuff. I'm Anglican, a high church Anglican. And this priest said, well, I got a bishop in town, let's go over there. I said, okay. They showed up with a thurifer, 2 candle guys, the bishop, 3 priests, and an acolyte at the front door. Whitney opens the door, and she sees these people. She's never been to church in her life. She sees these people, and she's like, what in the world? And they come in, and they you know, do their deal. So one day I go over to be at her house, and they're bringing the oxygen in, and the oxygen guy's hooking the tank up, and he takes her in the back to hook the tank up, and he comes back, and he's helping Jennifer, and the guy comes back, and he says to the other guy, you need to come in the back. I think we have a problem. And they go in the back, and what the problem is Jennifer has no oxygen. Her numbers are so low that we have to put her in the hospital. And she won't go to the hospital because she says she's going to live. I'm going to live because I'm going to live for my daughter. I'm going to live. So we go to the hospital, and we have to take her to the hospital. And Scotty, who's like her sweetheart, won't let her go. And she's never told Whitney that she's going to die. She's always going to live. And because of you guys and because of program, I knew how to open up our home to her. I mean, she's a part of our family. And today she's giving me a birthday party because she came home to live with us. And our kids welcomed her in the house. She never went to program with us. but she's married now, and she's a great gal. But we took her home to live, and the boys brought her in, because we're used to having people around the house. We're used to being and doing those kinds of things. That's what we do for each other. We save each other's lives here. We participate with each other here. That's how we do it. So during all of this stuff, at one point, remember when we had the earthquake? So miracles in motion. Okay, here's one of the miracles, Mark. We have the earthquake. Mikey's living on the other side of the house. The Alatines know where it is. Those guys know where. He's on the other side of the house. Toscan's in the bedroom across from us. The earthquake happens. We are in the middle of the earthquake. Mikey's screaming from his room because all the cabinets in his, all the armoire fell over and he couldn't find his way out and he couldn't find his glasses and blah, blah, blah. Now, Toscan, I had to go in his bedroom and wake him up. He's our little drinker. He's our little drug addict. There's Toscan, our little drug addict. Sweet, sweet, darling kid. So we all jump out of bed, and we don't sleep with a lot of clothes on in our house. And so I run out, and I get the laundry, and I'm throwing people clothes. And we go out in the middle of the yard, and it's so gorgeous outside. It's dark. The lights are off. You know what we do as a family? We gather around, we hold hands, and we said the Lord's Prayer. That's the first thing that we did. We all gathered around, said the Lord's Prayer, looked up at the stars, knew we were going to be okay. Michael said, we need to go over to Dottie's house, see how she is, because she's a single woman living alone. Michael wanted to go see how Renee was and how the people were. So we're going all over doing things. And we just had this earthquake, and our house was destroyed. And we lived in our guest house and my studio for 6 months. Michael and I had a little bedroom, the kids were in the boat, and we lived that way for 6 months. And we got closer and closer together, never stopped going to meetings, never stopped doing what we were going to do, rebuilt the house, blah, blah, blah. So the kids are growing up. Now Michael's going to an Alateen meeting. And now he started, Jesse is his sponsor. They've got great sponsors. The most active Alateens you'd ever want to see. They're constantly in our yard. Toscan's hair is standing up like they can't, nobody can figure out how he makes his hair stand up. He's doing commercials, you know. He's cuter than whatever. He's going to a high school, junior high, and they want to kill him because he's going to San Fernando and he looks like a light bulb, you know. I mean, and the dean calls and says, you got to come pick him up. You can put him in any school you want, but if you leave him here, he's going to get killed. And I thought, okay, so he can go to another one. And so Michael is starting to transition to go to Al-Anon meetings, and so is Lisa. And there, Michael and Lisa are together. So it's Sunday night. I'm in bed. Michael's in bed. Lisa and Michael walk in to our bedroom. I thought, I really like Lisa, but I don't really know why Lisa's in my bedroom. And our son has this Cheshire Cat look about him. And he goes, we're pregnant. What do you think? And Michael's in bed and he goes, I think you should have thought. So Mikey was supposed to go back to college. We had it all arranged. He was going to go to college, and now we've got this situation that's happening, and the grandfather, and this. Long story short, they have a beautiful, small wedding, gorgeous, darling. I've got the most beautiful granddaughter. She's 23, 24 now. She's awesome. Two little other grandkids from them. You know, they're Alateens. Now they're adults. Now they're full-grown, beautiful parents that love their kids and have a great time. That's amazing. That's miracles in action. So now Whitney's living in the house. So now Toscan's in Michael's bedroom, and Whitney's in Toscan's bedroom, and we're all living at the house, and they're both in the same grade. They're both the same age. And Toskin comes into the bedroom and he says, I gotta go and, I think this is a lie that he told me, but he says, I gotta go and copy some papers and I'll be back. So he leaves for a project for school. So he leaves and I go to go out into the hallway and I open the bedroom door and there's smoke all the way down below my hips already in the house. The house is full of smoke. So I bend over to put my head in the clear air and scream, the house is on fire, we need to get out. So Whitney and I all jump out and we all go outside and our house burns down. Toskin comes back and he thinks he's burnt the house down. Michael has filled his lungs up and he's going to the hospital. So I call my priest. Michael's going to the hospital. This is what's happening. The house is burning down. My sister comes over. My sponsee comes over. We're sitting watching the house burn. And we have skylights. So I'm sitting across the street and I'm watching this skylight goes, explodes and flames. This one, and my sister goes, what about Mom? I said, Annette, Mom is dead. And she said, I know, but her ashes are in the house. I know. I'm like, well, I don't think it's going to hurt her anything. I can't do anything about it. And then I just, this is way more than I can deal with. So what happens is I call the priest. He says, I'll go to the hospital with Michael because they've taken him by ambulance. They think he's having a heart attack. I'm going to take care of what this is. I call one of Michael's buddies in program, and the buddy in program says, does fire reclamation. And he goes, do not let anyone on the property. I will call. He got us a guard to come to the house, blah, 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 blah. This is what's going to happen. Where else in the world do you have all of these people at your fingertips who do so many different things that we call upon because we're friends. We know each other. We know how to help each other. If you're new here, or even just a little bit new, get yourself into an active, active group that helps each other, does things together, has parties together, celebrates life and recovery together, you know? Because it'll save your life and it'll save your kids' life. If you have kids, please try to get them into Alateen. Alateen looks a little strange to me these days. It's sad to me to not see Alateen. I was at San Fernando and I went to the Alateen meeting and all the Alateens were they were sitting on the front tables, were all on their phone the whole time the speaker was speaking. I thought, I want to smack their faces. Well, how are you going to recover like that? Give me that damn phone. I didn't do it, but I really wanted to. So my life has been full. It's been big and full and full of life. Our children are well, and they're happy. Toskin chooses not to go to program. He went to program for a while, and he has great friends. The people in his life that he met in Alateen, a lot of them are still his best friends, still his very best friends. Mikey, Michael and I are having a big anniversary party, and he said, Mom, save a place for blah, 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 blah. I said, I already have. He said, you have? I said, they're your best friends. Of course I'll save them a place. And they're all going to come out, and we're going to party, and we're going to have a good time. Because in recovery, we get to live and we get to have a life beyond our wildest dreams. I want to thank you for sitting through this and listening to my miracles in motion. The only one I didn't tell you is about my mom. When my mom was dying, I was doing this particular job. I've had a lot of jobs to make money. And I was calling people to go on whatever, you know, want to go on this, go on to that. And I said this prayer to God, and if I ask God to help me and my heart really means it and I'm being really truthful, God always shows up for me. I said, God, my mom's dying. If there's anything you could do to allow me to be with my mom in these last days, I would really appreciate it. I finished my prayer, I went back to work. About 5-10 minutes later, I looked on my front porch, and it looked like there were all these people. I thought, God, the Jehovah's Witnesses are really dressed nicely today. They were really nicely dressed. And it was DreamWorks. And they came and they rented our property for $35,000 to do a movie. Almost Famous was the movie. Why not? Bunch of drunks. And partiers just like us. And I was able to go and be with my mom and not work. Whatever I ask God for something that I want to do because it means so much to me and I want to be of service, God answers it with a yes. And for that, I'm forever grateful. Thanks for listening to me. Thank you.